Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 132, a special episode in which we are presenting some recorded events from the 2025 Academy of Management Annual Meeting held in Copenhagen, Denmark. For part two, we are presenting a professional development workshop titled Queer Eye for Academics, Skills for Navigating Academic Life, hosted by Lauren Kaufman from the University of Virginia and our own Pedro Monteiro from the Copenhagen Business School. Along with Lauren and Pedro, the panelists include Jonas Friedrich from the University of St. Gallen, Mika Rajanov from the University of Alberta, Anthony Myers from the City University of New York, and Vinicius Galante from the Sao Paulo School of Business Administration. To learn more about the event, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. The recording has been edited to remove extensive background noise and for brevity, and some portions had to be re-recorded. Here is our co-organizer and host, Pedro Monteiro.
Thank you for making the journey all the way from Bella or whatever you came from to the Design Museum. It's wonderful to see you all. We are here for the Queer Eye session. I'm one of the organizers. My name is Pedro Monteiro and your daughter, Lauren. You know, we put this together. I'll introduce the panelists later. But before we start with the actual content of the event, I think some words of conduct were in order. This is a slide shared from the OMT division. That tries to remind us what we are here to do, right? And what kind of conduct that we expect to have during the conference. So just read it quickly, right? The idea is that there are expectations, there are values and norms that are supposed to guide the way we conduct ourselves during the conference. In terms of expectations, it's about that we are here to learn, no surprise, but bear sometimes repeating, and to engage in thoughtful content, to have insightful exchanges and building connections. The values that the Academy wants to see itself represent is about responsibility, integrity, respect, dignity, right? And I think in a PDW like this, particularly relevant to highlight them. And finally, in terms of conduct, well, we all click box, but we don't think about that very much. But that, you know, when we are registering to be part of the Academy, it means that there are some codes of conduct, professional norms that we say that we are going to know abide by, and also to try to pay attention to the surrounding around us, right? So just, that was the, general spiel, but now onto the content. So as I said, we are the session called Queer Eye for Academics, the idea is to share skills, and together with Lauren, we put this together. And I wanna start with a story. So we met in a summer school, I think, some years ago, and always had during AOM our career moment in which we shared our perspective on what it meant to navigate the career as queer people. But we always felt that even though there are so many caucuses, PDWs, symposia on this topic and experience of queer people, it's always very inward focusing, right? About how we feel and how it is, which is important. But especially in a time like this, we wanted to create a way to have bridges and include everyone because queer people exist in a larger environment, right? So what about have a session that puts everyone in conversation? And you think about queer, not just in terms of something about sex and gender, but a particular kind of experience, right? Related to being a minority, to having some struggles that can be maybe translatable, and there can be some transferable skills that we can share from, you know, having such experience. So that's the idea here. And we thought that the model of the Queer Eye show would be a good one, because if you haven't seen it, but you should, we strongly encourage, is basically a group of people that remake, you know, try to do a makeover of some people in terms of new design, personal development, and so on. And that's kind of, you know, our inspiration here. So to do that, we have selected a great panel of people that are going to share a variety of skills. We have Jonas Friedrich from the University of St. Gallen. We have
Nika Rajanov from University of Alberta, Vinicius Galante from FGV, São Paulo School of Business, and Anthony Myers from the Graduate Barrow College and the Graduate Center at CUNY. So the agenda is the following. We are going to start by having some presentations about each different skill. They are listed here. And the idea is that we wanted to focus on skills that are common to the profession, like presenting or finding your research identity, but with, of course, a queer twist on that. And then we're going to have a Q&A. So, you know, set up the chairs here to have a conversation with the panel. And then we're going to have the round tables, right, in which we are going to expand on each skill. And just a quick conclusion after. So that was the intro. And now we're going to have the first presentation by Lauren on Serve It With Style, Presenting With Panache.
Thank you. So I don't know if you could hear it earlier, but I was playing Heated from Beyoncé's album Renaissance. And this is what we're going for, 10, 10, 10 across the board. And she has notes because she's jet lagged. I'm Lauren, I'm a tenure track professor of ethics at the Darden School at the University of Virginia. My research is on impact measurement and management and impact investing. I'm particularly interested in gender. That's my academic stuff. And when Pedro had this incredible idea of hosting this PDW, I was like, okay, well, which Fab Five member am I going to be? And I feel like there's the aspirational one of like, I want to be France. But I'm not sure. I want to be Tan France. So I don't know. We'll see. I'm not sure if we'll get there. But how do we serve with style? This is the question. And so I feel like there's always that moment in the Queer Eye series, for those who have seen it, where it's like after the makeover, you look at yourself in the mirror and you can see that not only have you changed outwardly, but something inwardly happened too. And I think that's what it means to serve with style. Yes. Your audience is going to be impressed, they're going to learn something, but I also think it's about proving to yourself that you have something to say. And the TLDR is that great presentations are not about nailing the slide deck, they're not about having backup fonts just in case the computer doesn't match your fonts, have been there. It's about presence. I think it's about showing up authentically, like this baby absolutely waving the slide right now and just owning your space. And communicating in a way that creates connection. And thinking about how to talk about some fun personas, as I'm going through this, I want us to think about which one of these are you, which of these architects of presentation, and which would you like to be? And I've tried to mash these up with some queer icons. It's kind of US-centric, apologies for that. But first, I think we've all come across the whisperer, the person who kind of like fades into the podium, like he reads off of their notes, they're not really capturing your attention. Who is that? Obviously Kristen Stewart. And what I think will clear eye twist on that is, honey, we want to be heard, right? You're not doing yourself or your ideas justice if you're hiding behind the theory, if you're hiding behind the podium. And there are ways to nevertheless maybe have the like cool, mysterious vibe, but still get your point across. Okay, then we have the data dump. We've all been in this strategy seminar when it's just 50 slides, no air to breathe, you're totally overwhelmed, and the person's personality isn't even coming through. It's just all of the content. Janamana, queen though she is, I do think at the start of her career was, you know, just like talking a lot about Afrofuturism and giving you a lot of facts and a lot of information. But over the course of her career, the emotion was able to come out, right? The emotion which was buried was able to come out and became more about her personality, her story. We want the cyborg and the soul, basically. So give us your stats and more sass. We want your take on what the data means. Help us understand it, put us in your shoes. Third is the performer. So the person who has the charisma, the sparkle, the high drama, but maybe is a little bit more shallow on content. And again, respectfully, Billy Porter always serves on the red carpet, to be clear, but I think also learn to bring more vulnerability to the presentation and more substance to match the glam. I think another way of thinking about this is that glitter lands harder when there's a little bit of grit underneath. And I think that makes you and your ideas so much more accessible to folks when you show both. And finally, the grounded storyteller, the presenter who mixes data and stories with ease, of course, the queen of all, Laverne, learning to serve with both soul and structure, giving you data and the story, giving you how and the why. So I want you to think about it. Maybe we can get more into this at the roundtables or the Q&A. Which of these are you, be honest, and which of these would you like to be and why? Okay. So what are we aiming for here? The presentation trinity I put together again respectfully. First, I witnessed her earlier this month in DC on her Cowboy Carter tour, and it was a master class in presentation. Just incredible. And so I think one way to serve it with style and ground authenticity is to use your voice. So even if you're the Kristen Stewart whispering mousy behind the podium, you can still practice how to drop every point on the beat, how to use silence, how to use movement, how to use eye contact to make your point in a way that Queen Bee does beautifully. I also think centering your why. Again, I could have chosen many icons here, but I think Lady Gaga is a great example of this. Every performance, whether it's avant-garde or acoustic, is rooted in purpose for her. She's weird, she's raw, but she's intentional. And I think that centering the why of the story, the engine behind the narrative, is another way to really shine. And thirdly, leave them with a feeling. So Whitney Houston, she didn't just sing, she baptized you in emotion. And so I think often with our professional presentations, we give you the facts, we give you the figures, but I want to know why it matters to you. Why is your research important to you? Not just to the field, not just to the journal, but to you. Like when I think about the presentations that stick the most with me, it's because the researcher told me why they did it, why it was an interesting problem or something that they faced and practiced. And so you don't have to be flashy to be fabulous, and confidence isn't loud. It's clear, grounded, and you. And so I think about bringing the Beyoncé voice, the Gaga why, and the Whitney feeling to serve it with panache. And for tens across the board, these are the takeaways from this session. So this is what I want to leave you with. Confidence is a skill, not a vibe. That's something everyone can have, and you can practice it. The first time I gave a presentation, I was parched. Like, I got so nervous, I needed water. So I think I'm doing a little better, right? It's because you practice. The voice and posture are free accessories, so wear them well. A humble queen says both thank you, and I think this is a totally underutilized bullet, is I don't know. Like, how many presentations have we been to when someone was asked a question and they made up an answer and it was so obvious they were BSing? I think there's real power in saying honestly and authentically to your audience, yeah, I don't know the answer to that, and I'm going to get back to you. No need to perform what you think is Professor Drag unless you want to. I think authenticity always just means showing up as yourself, and lastly, of course, leaving them with a feeling and not just facts. So thank you so much for your time, and I'll hand it off to our next team member of Team Slay.
Really talking about crafting your research identity. So I've been very, very intentional about how I chose my research topics and how they relate to myself. So I'll just begin. Before coming to academia, I worked in tech startups. I was a product manager, designer, engineer, all that stuff. And it was kind of boring. Good jobs, good pay, but I was bored. And I was going through some very difficult life stuff. Basically, I was transitioning. And I couldn't find any resources that spoke to me. So I started a small blog, and that grew and grew and grew and grew. And I started presenting at conferences, and I was presenting at conferences while I was learning what I was presenting. And speaking of presentations, my very first presentation ever was like 50 slides, and the slides didn't work, and there was like 100 people in the room, and I just talked through everything. It was so much information, but like trial by fire, you know? And then I kept being sort of invited to present at more conferences. I got into medical education, so I will present to doctors. I called myself Micah No Letters because I was not qualified. Like, who, I, you know, these are doctors, nurses, like actual qualified people. Why am I presenting? But I felt like I had something to say that wasn't being said. And I was just driven by that. And I used a very approachable way that people could relate to it. As you probably know, in peer circles, there's a lot of jargon and politicized, and I took a very, like, just pragmatic, grounded approach. And my career took off, and I call it a career because I was very dedicated. Even though I was working, this is what I did at work. And I volunteered. I started doing research a little bit. I got a consulting job, and eventually I wrote a book. It took 6 years. So when someone told me about the dissertation, I was not intimidated. I've been there, don't worry. So that happened for a while, and then I decided to pursue a PhD for various reasons, mostly because someone once asked me, what's been your favorite job? And I said, school. So there was a clear answer. So I applied to PhD programs, and by this point, I was really burned out from my activism work. It can be a really toxic community. It's very intense work. It's very personal work. And I decided to sort of quote unquote retire from that and put all my energy into my PhD, which was also very intense work. So you really kind of have to just go all in. But when I applied to programs, I was really intentional about not researching anything related to queerness, to diversity, to DEI, equality, race, gender, class, like none of that. I was very, very intentional because I was so burned out from it and I wanted some distance. And also, I honestly really wasn't that interested. Like, I wanted to study work. I didn't want to study trans health. I could have gotten a PhD in social work or public health. So I was applying and I would get sometimes inappropriate questions, to be honest, because I did put in my application that I had this history. And one of the interviewees asked me, you know, why don't you want to study this? And I said, honestly, because a lot of what you're researching is things we already know. We're just putting it into words that are intelligible to academics and making it real. And there's great people who are doing this very necessary work, but I want to study things that I don't know about, that I'm genuinely curious about. So my first project, I got invited into this project about AIDS doctors during the AIDS epidemic, which was really cool because it was queer adjacent, but it wasn't anything to do with what I didn't want to do. I actually was very interested in identity, which is, you can see the connection. But professional identity, not any social demographics identity. My dissertation was on esports, which is professional video gamers. And so it's kind of queer in the way that it was weird and strange and not very mainstream setting. I got a lot of no's, but I went ahead anyway. And it turned out great. I'm really proud of it. And I now have to publish it at some point. And so actually I would get a lot of questions when I was presenting both of these projects, especially with the gamers, like, where are the demographics? Where are the women? Where are the queer people? I'm like, I don't care. That's not what I'm researching. There's actually already a lot of research on that. Can we please focus on the theories that I'm interested in? You kind of are expected to care about these things as a minority scholar, and there's a double bind, right? You're expected to do this kind of research, you're expected to be interested in it, but if you are, then you're tokenized, and you're pigeonholed, and your research isn't objective enough, and like, oh, you're the minority scholar who does this minority work. And I had this great conversation with someone last week about this, and that's part of why I also didn't want to do this kind of work very intentionally, other than I was burned out about it, is I don't want to be pigeonholed as this researcher who does queer research, and that's all you do, and it's a very marginal area in management. So then I graduate, and I get this random email in my inbox by this guy, Michael Lounsbury, who says, I have a perfect postdoc for you. We just got funding to create a LGBT entrepreneurship knowledge hub I need a strong qualitative researcher, and I hear you're it. So we did a few Zoom talks. We convinced each other why we should do it. Obviously, Adapted Up, turning out great. It's funded by the Government of Canada, which I'm very grateful for, because if it were US-based, this grant would have been canceled and I'd be out of a job right now, which is very scary. But it also brings to light why this work is important. And so I was sort of thrown back into the queer world. A little bit unwillingly, I wasn't searching for this, but it's actually been really, really nice to reconnect with a community that I felt I was so distant for 6 years. It's nice to rediscover research in a new light. Now that I've matured, I have my own research identity, I found myself, I feel really grounded, and now I can dive into this without feeling like I'm being forced into something I don't want to do. And actually, Michael has been really, really into queer theory and query management, which is very exciting because it's very risky and it's very marginalized still in the field. And to have someone who's actually cheerleading and wanting to bring this in is really, really, it brings me a lot of enthusiasm and makes me want to take that risk and put my stamp on the field. So I've gone sort of from, I don't even want to hear about this, to like full on, let's go, let's do this, let's bring this into management. Yeah. And just to tell you a little bit about the research we're doing, we're building an entrepreneurship knowledge hub. When we met, I called him, I don't study entrepreneurship, I don't know why you want me, but he did. And we're traveling all across Canada. What I also like is it's very like practice oriented. It's very much about benefiting the community. He came with the frame of emancipatory entrepreneurship, which is about emancipating everyone's collectively oriented, community oriented, and I have to write these reports. So it's not just writing academic papers that three people will read in 5 years. So you actually get to reconnect with what I did, which is, you know, grassroots work and talking to people on the ground. And I just want to end with showing you why I'm so burned out, because I've been traveling all over Canada doing this work. I have a little twist, which is that I live in Florida. Long story, but I don't live in Canada. I live in next to Miami, so that's where I am. And as you can see, I've traveled a lot of places in Canada, and it's not even been a full year since September. So I live in an airplane. I'm very burned out, but the fieldwork has been really cool. A lot of it has been hearing stories that are not surprising to me, that are same old, same old. But one cool thing is I have a co-author colleague who is not queer. And it's really cute seeing the world through her eyes, like all these things about the queer world that are new to her, and she asks all these questions. And I think that's been really cool to sort of share that knowledge with her and see it through a different lens, you know, and it also helps that we're gonna bring this into an audience that is probably not familiar with this. So that's been really grounding as well. I guess back to reframing my research identity. So when I was on the market, my identity was sort of the significance of work and the meaning of work. And now with this project, through a twist in my pipeline, I'm reframing it as work on the margins, which I think resonates and still doesn't put me in that tiny little box that I didn't want to be in, but gets me closer to sort of expressing myself.
So it's not easy to be here after Laura presented Abed.
Present the book to Mesh in English, not the first. And the language. So I count on the solidarity of the audience. So, okay, we are here, we are in the academia, it's 2025, and we want to talk about our experience, we want to seek up our souls. The other point is how we do this in order to be heard, is to be effectively heard, and also protect ourselves. Because they cannot forget the rewards of a vulnerable group. So I want to share some reflections I had on this on my experience through the revision process of an article
that I presented on that I published in Journey of Eric in the organization a couple of years ago. And is, I remember that the reviewers like SOPG, okay, we understand what you're saying. It's interesting and we want to hear more, but could you tell me in a specific situation or the people that were involved or the organization in DISEC? Actually, I have a lot of situations that I could tell, but if I'm just a PhD student and I had to perfect myself in order to first career in this academia. And so I decided to just share with them a general situation. I think here is the cue because we are talking about the stuff that happens everything. So everything that we say is very relatable and plausible. So you can narrate situations that happened in our lives, driving lives of outside organizations, outside the police stores. But people can imagine that this program can go inside, so we can make our reflections with the context. We're having nice the context in which we are trying to advocate for ourselves. So we are in entire generally context. For some reason, talking about the politics is as a political agenda. So we have to be very careful about the words we use and how we talk about it. And Stanley Comments said to us that the crucial thing for diversity and inclusion and equity in the next years is about how it's going to thrive and survive in an anti-genetic context. So that's individually what we are thinking. Okay, we want to speak up. From my experience, I get the impression that as more I talk, the more I get respect, the more impact I do, and the more I can spend out in my career. So it's important. And if there is supposed to approach DNI context within academia, so we can talk about our experience, but just have in mind what we have to take care of some what's going to happen after our finish our PhD or personally I agree in academia. So I prepared a list of do unknowns. I think it's a very thing that can help us and very like it's a Queer Eye show in the original one. So it's a little unfair to blame people or institutions or organizations or business school for start a process that took like centuries and centuries to be happening now. So we can blame people or then about being racist or being misogynist or being homophobic. We want to talk about this context without the abstract ideas. So the point is, NetJet should never address people or organizations directly. I also remember was reviewers asked me to talk more about the specific situations, and if I cannot do that, I have in several examples, but and I can give you a lot of examples outside organizations and business schools, and you will see that it's very relatable and plausible. And we have expressed in the power of narratives when you speak about narratives and personal experience. It resonates with other people and it makes sense to them. So we cannot narrate any specific situation, but you narrate everyday situation happened to us and how with that just based on that. We want to talk to all. We don't want to preach to equals because it's easier to talk to people that are more into our dialogue and our questions about diversity, inclusion, racism, homophobia, all kind of discrimination. But if you want to make a change, we have to impact
as much people as possible. And we have so many people with us, not at least us. So we don't want anybody to get attacked. Our nurse, what harm is just making them and join us. And by the end, I just want to realize that we have to be generous. I mean, we all have examples inside our community of those kind of discriminations of behaviors and actions. There are racist and survival or misogynist or are homophobic. So we cannot be point our finger as anyone and or any institution in the point is you can be generous and just our purpose is to help us the people to get better and to be part of our change, our expectation. So that was it.
I'm starting already to say thank you to Pedro and Lauren. This really is, I think, something very important for the Academy. It's really beautiful that we have this event here and that we can all share this skills session. And I will be reflecting a little bit about how we can bring queer into the classroom, because of course, queer precarity is everywhere. And of course, if we are in a teaching position, you of course can use that space also to try to bring transformation from within there. And I also think we really undervalue and underestimate how queer theory, I mean, theorizing of people who have been oppressed for long, can actually give us hints on how to do transformation in, I would say, in a subversive way, in a way which is sometimes not very kind of straightforward, which is sometimes not only like not very much in your face, speaking about the oppression or inequalities we are facing, but still are strategies to transform. And yeah, I'm very happy that I can give a few insights from a course I could co-teach a few years already with Chris Stayard. He's a professor at University of St. Gallen, and it's a course on creativity and team dynamics. You see actually one of the last performances of a duo. So the course starts very early, already very embodied and including all the senses, really. From the start, the students are asked to find a creative duo and investigate them ethnographically or with interviews, and then create their own performance over the course of the semester, and then present their findings also as a performance to then finally write a reflection paper. And here you see also practically how they've actually researched an architecture office, how they actually included us as a whole group into a performance outside kind of a backyard kind of thing of the university, which is very ugly, and then transformed in kind of a world-building activity you can see there. And I want to theorize this with a paper Chris Stayard wrote on if a revolt is to come, it has to come from the senses. And he leans on Michael Serres' understanding of this sensual revolt and also on queer phenomenology of Sara Ahmed. And the understanding is really that the senses, the smell, the touch, the being outside, that the experience really can decenter us from kind of from straight lining understandings of how we experience the world and also how we usually learn at university. So one provocation I want to bring in, queer theory would really invite us to bring more senses into our classrooms and use that not as a content element, but really as kind of a almost pedagogical or didactic element in our classrooms. So there's a grading scheme in Switzerland, which goes from 1 to 6. 1 is the worst grade, with 4 you fail. And this student, in the end of this course, wrote this paper, the reasons why this paper deserves a A1, which is beyond failing. he really made a very programmatic essay on how failure has been part of this learning journey in this course, and how he also actually believes we should fail him right now. And I want to give this as an example also for the second provocation that we really should involve the understanding of failure in our courses and endorse that for the students. And that of course can be linked to Halberstam's work on the queer art of failure. yeah, it is said that this, of course, makes us more creative, more cooperative, and surprising ways of being in the world can be experienced of failing. For example, if I fall here on the ground, you know, something that, you know, we don't expect in academic contexts. We could really try to create practices also as teachers to support others to fail and then be vulnerable and say, hey, sit down for a moment, you know, how are you feeling? Are you all right? Did you break something? Endorsing really that a failure is okay, that is actually part of an unsettling of a straight-lined understanding of how to present in that context here. Another context could be really how we write reflection papers. So I like the understanding that we can be Valentines for failure as teachers in the classroom. But I also want to caution there that, of course, one also has to create a lot of security that if people fail, that also is then in the end accepted and put into into an understanding of learning and, of course, also in the end, the grade, which is still something we can more difficultly evade from in the classroom. So, lastly, this is actually the first session of the course where we ask them about their worst group experience, also already foreshadowing a little bit on the failure element of the course. Here I want to speak about a theory which has become very dear to me during my PhD. A theory from José Esteban Muñoz was really theorized how we can disidentify from oppressive realities of queer folks through performances and really transform through performances the world towards a more inclusive space. And I think what really inspires me is that he makes clear that his strategy of transformation is really one which does not fully disidentify from the old, doesn't want to make a revolutionary cut, but rather a slow iterative process where we recycle some of the old elements and bring new elements in. That again also speaks to kind of the subversive at times and kind of slow but witty process I think that queer theorists often offer us to think about. How can we slowly, with doing small steps, small iterations of doing things differently, appearing differently in the classroom, being yourself vulnerable, for example, or being yourself outgoing, or whatever it really falls out of the script but enables others to embrace their plurality. How that can be a slow process, and we can also be proud of that slow process, amidst the many precarities we face in this world. Thank you.
I just realized I did not put the cast of Queer Eye in my presentation. I missed that. And some put the new cast, the old cast. I missed that.
That's okay.
So I had the task of talking about care. I'm a rising fifth year doctoral candidate in New York. So when I was asked to participate in this PDW, I was considering which skill I thought would be critical to examine. And I determined care or caring was an important skill because it involved an intentional and learned, a practical ability to respond to others with attunement and empathy, responsibility and action, thinking about contexts that were relational, social, and also in organizational contexts. And when I thought about the topic of care, I was thinking about how I wanted to approach it. So I actually went to theory. So care theory, it studies the nature of caring relations. And so these caring relations characterize the consciousness and behavior between the one caring, the carer, and the one that's cared for, the person receiving care. And that there are three features of the caring relations. So first, there's the carer that seeks to tend to the needs of the cared for. So they want to know what the cared for needs. They want to ask, like, what do you need? And then there's this second stage of motivational displacement. They want to put aside their motivational needs to get a sense of what the cared for needs, and they put their own needs aside. And then once they have a sense of what the cared for needs, they take action. And as long as they don't harm anyone else within their web of care, they take action. So there are these three stages of the caring relations. So I thought about this sort of nature of caring relations and thinking about how that impacts fostering communities of care. And so how does care theory play out? And I proposed three intentions around fostering communities of care. And I propose that you find your people, you understand your impact, and then you remember to reflect care inward. So I'll talk a little bit about how that impacts me and my experiences. First, with finding your own people and thinking about that experience as one who is a carer and one who is the cared for. So in my experience with advisors, faculty, with peers in my own program, and with outside affiliations, these are active relationships. You play an active role in determining how you present yourself. How do you evaluate these relationships? How do you nourish yourself in these relationships? If there are intentions to develop caring relationships, do you understand which role you play? Are you the carer? Are you the cared for? If you're intended to be a given role, examine why you aren't getting what you need. So when I think about my relationships with my advisors and faculty, developing honest relationships that are built on respect and maturity were really important for me. When I entered my relationships in my doctoral program, I came in with a whole life before them. And that was important for me to enter that relationship knowing that I'm a whole human being before coming in. And I know that there were other doctoral students that were really nervous to come in and talk with their advisors, and they were really scared, and they felt like they couldn't come in confident. And some of them felt actually a little mistreated by their advisors, and they couldn't speak up. And that's not how I approached my relationships. And my advisors and faculty really understood that. And we had a very different type of relationship because of that. And we were able to develop relationship as actual peers. I respected their credentials, their experience, their knowledge. I was able to grow and learn from them, but they were also able to respect that I had a whole career, decades of experience, and we were still able to have an exchange because of that. So I was still able to be cared for by them, but also have a different type of relationship than maybe some of my other peers in the program. So we were able to develop a different type of peer and relationship. In terms of my relationship with peers in my academic program, there was a sense of isolation that I felt when I first started the program. When you're in a doctoral program, you're given all of these tasks when you're in the classes, and I'm sitting at home trying to do all these things that I've never done before, and I'm in like my regression analyses and all these things, and I'm like, oh my God, what the hell am I doing? One day I just like reached out to members in my class and I said, could you like to be a study group? And they said, what? What is that? They had never thought to do anything like that. And over time we actually started to check in with each other and really do sessions and study sessions together and go over like, hey, how did you approach doing this problem and, you know, coding and all that stuff. And over time, we actually felt like we could check in with each other and have like co-working sessions. And we actually felt like we could take care of each other when we were stressed out prepping for our exams. And some of them had never had study sessions before or even like had a person that they felt like they could check in with. And in that set, in that point, while I felt like I could be a carer for someone, I felt like I was taken care of because I was reducing my sense of isolation. And then outside affiliations, I'm a part of an organization called the PhD Project, which helps to diversify business schools. When I started my PhD program, I had joined this organization. The members of the program reached out to me. They didn't even know me. And they helped me even with like applying to programs. And I was shocked at, they were like, hey, how are you filling out your application? And I didn't understand why they wanted to help me. They didn't know me. And they helped me with drafting applications, doing interviews. Like, they were like, how are you answering these questions? Like, how are you writing your statement of purpose? You know, all of those things. And so once I got into my program, I started attending member sessions, and I got really close to other members of the organization. I got really connected to the different affiliate groups that were connected to the PhD project, and I actually wound up becoming the president of the Management Doctoral Student Association. And so in the beginning, I was cared for, and I wound up becoming a carer. And I wound up helping with things like supporting folks when they were prepping for comps. I was organizing sessions with folks who had already taken the comps to come back and talk about how they had prepped and what their experiences were like and other sorts of services. So actually, during this AOM, I'm actually giving my outgoing speech after being a year in this role. So really thinking about how you transition from one role to another and how do you go from being supported to supporting others is an interesting process. And that even when you're in the role of being cared for, there's still a reciprocal aspect to that relationship, to being a carer as well. Understand your impact. Your research, knowledge production also can be a tool of care. Think about your impact to society when you're generating knowledge. Representation and respect matter in your research design. Sean Wilson, in his research as ceremony, he examined indigenous methodology. He described the term relational accountability, which talks about actions taken in the research process that must be accountable to all relationships, including with people, participants, communities, colleagues, the ancestors, and the environment, ideas, knowledge systems, your writing, your citations. Think about who you cite in your work. Sarah Ahmed talked about citing feminists of color as the site of rebellion. Think about you being aware of your positionality as a scholar and how that shapes your perspective in generating work. And then your work as co-authors, taking responsibility in how you communicate with your co-authors, taking accountability, and maintaining trust in your process. And then remember how to reflect care forward, inward, using the same tools as you would as a carer with a care for outside of the relationship with others, reflecting that inward. If you need to seek outside resources for healing inside to take care of yourself, find it. And then the ways that you reflect care inward, it impacts how you show up for others. So really think about that. And then, here are some recommended steps for fostering communities of care. Establishing then accountability groups. That's really important to generating communities of care. Connect with others to support others and also support yourself. Sometimes you need to be accountable to yourself in doing the work. Reevaluate your own caring relationships with others to make sure that they are supporting you and supporting the other person. Practice intentional citation. Embed care and institutional practices and policy. Boundary setting, say no if you need to say no. And practice reflexivity and ongoing self-inquiry. And that's it, thank you.
Thank you, Anthony. So it's my pleasure to do the closing presentation for the PDW. And the skill I'll be talking about is diva worshiping. And of course, I know that the word diva usually has negative connotations, right? You tend to think that someone takes much space, much demanding, was too much. But I want to do with the word what we did with the word queer, right? Which is to try to show that the only reason that we think of that as negative is because there are norms and values that make those subjectivity to be seen as such. Right, so I also want to show that maybe we have to think in terms of the divas, in terms of less of that connotations and try to say, well, why and how and what ways can we care and recognize each other? So I'm going to use that idea to think about recognition that we can give to each other, which we know is important. And I have here what is probably going to be the diva of many scholars in the world, Marie Curie, And I think of her as my Beyoncé, Lauren.
The idea is that we all know her, you know, of her. She's certainly someone that would be admired.
You know, I just had some screenshots to show that a bunch of initiatives in the European Union use her as the big symbol of everything. But if you start scratching the surface, there is another story here that, you know, I didn't know before I started digging, which is that Marie Curie was a subject with a lot of harassment on the press. Right? It was, you know, there was a lot of negative press about her because she had the relationship of, you know, with a married person, and it was so bad that the Academy in Norway, when she, not the Norway, the Swedish one, when she received her second Nobel, didn't want her to show up to pick up the prize. Albert Einstein wrote a letter to her encouraging her to go. And besides that, when a position opened at the French Academy of Sciences, right, that she put up, ran the election, the press had smear campaigns about her using racist claims, using this kind of racist science, trying to kind of use these graphological maps or physiognomic maps to try to show that she was not really this or that, right? There were all sorts of rumors in the press as well that she was not really French, not really deserving, and so on. She didn't win that election, but you know, who cares? She has done the contribution that we know to knowledge. But I think that it's interesting to see that even someone that in this case is so appreciated today, and was not even queer, right, because the whole point is to go beyond just talking about our own experience, has been subject of all that. And of course, there are so many parallels in what we are living today, right, and Mika was hinting at that already. Of course, the most emblematic figure is Alan Turing, which I'm sure all you know. He was central to the creation of the computer, but was convicted for homosexual acts, was chemically castrated and committed suicide. He was pardoned by Queen Elizabeth a few years, you know, recently. But there is so many others. This is just like images of people all around the world who do LGBTQ research or advocacy and so on, who have been subject of smear campaigns and even personal attacks or even imprisonment. So just to say that there is all of this happening. But the point here today is not just talk about the negative, it's to think about what we learn, because I think being queer is not just about being subject to violence, but also to be proud to be able to recognize each other, to organize for change, right? To validate each other, to stand as a diva when the world may want you to be shameful, but to stand in pride, right? And we do this together. That's why I have the image of one person, you know, put makeup on the other, which is, I think, you can think in terms of war paint, right? To be yourself. And to translate that in academic terms, because we write a lot, not just papers, but also evaluations and letters, I think that my language of love to recognition is by nominating people to honors and awards, right? And that's exactly the skill I want to talk to you about. And that is something that I have been doing for many, many years. You know, my friends know this. I think I've passed 100 nominations by now. And this has been both to colleagues that work with me at CBS, right? Junior, senior from the same level that I am, but also all sorts of people at the field level. And these have been both mentors, co-authors, colleagues, people that I've never met actually, people that are actually known quite a lot in the field, but I felt that needed some kind of recognition for a particular community or particular work, right? And what I'm gonna share to you is just three tips in the way I do such work. One is, I think that is who to select, right? And I'm going to share my own heuristic, which is first, I think that of course, to nominate someone for an honor, you have to think about the professional threshold. But what is important here is because we are all experts, knowledge workers, which means that we have our own personal professional judgment. So it's about not just number of citations or this and that, but what we believe as our judgment, someone has made a contribution to the body of knowledge. So listen to our own judgment as experts, right, and value that. Of course, ethical conduct. We sign codes of conduct when we are part of a community, so trying to understand what kind of the person is for the community. And my own heuristic that is more personal and idiosyncratic is what I think is deserving. And that can mean timelessness, right, in a particular situation, conversation, moment, or an oversight that I feel that a particular person or work has been done. So for example, I was very happy to nominate Renate Meyer for the OMT Distinguished Scholar Award, and I really wanted to nominate her, and I'm glad that she going to be honored on Monday, because it's, I think, the second time ever that the division has going to recognize someone beyond North America. And coming to Europe, the whole AOM, I thought it was only timely and fair to recognize work beyond North America, right? So So the other point is about which award. I'm sure that, you know, we have seen all kinds of emails, but there are plenty, both at AUM, at the division level, in other professional associations, sociology, strategy, economics, whatever it is. I usually get, you know, mailing alerts, I'm sure you too as well, but I usually what I do is just create a spreadsheet of the people I have been thinking of and waiting to see a particular one come up that I think is relevant. And third, perhaps most important, is to try, no surprise, to think about it as a collective work, right? Because the same way that we are trying to, you know, get honor and so on and recognize, it's about also working together to craft and get support for a nomination. And I think this is particularly important because out of the many nominations I did, very few succeeded, so to speak. Although I do love that Lego so much, and Jonas has given us, you know, some probes on that. Because I feel that the process, if it's collective, is itself an honor, because what scholars and professionals aspire the most, of course, peer recognition, because that's the whole point of our work, right? So I think that doing it collectively also indirectly has always a benefit of being an honor in itself as the process. And finally, I know that not everyone is going to turn into an excited letter nominating person, so I wanted to share a couple of things that are more low sale daily routine, right? That I find is maybe forms of care, right, that can be done. One is that writing, I read your work notes. I see a lot of posting on LinkedIn, and I'm guilty myself of that, about the publishing, but not the content, or being read, or what people thought about the paper, or how they're using the paper, right? So I thought about this when I have published a paper, and a colleague who is not queer, but has done a caring act, Mike Lee, sent me a note saying, I read the paper, and I think it's very interesting for this and that. Wow, I felt seen, I felt recognized, right? And I learned that journalists tend to do that as well. Value, not just the clicks, but also the letters they may get from someone saying, you know, I was there, I read your work and it makes sense. And the other one, and, you know, Anthony already said that, is cite broadly and try to cite in a way that you are trying to purposefully work into recognize people. And the trick I usually like to think is that we always know that it's about novelty and establishment, right? So in terms of transgression, it's always about what is acceptable, what is not. So I try to put in a brackets a recognized citation with one that's maybe less recognized to try to, you know, bring that together. So those are my kind of practical things. I just want to leave you with a message, going back to what I said about a community, because I think that being a peer in a community is not just about the negative critique, and it's invariably, there is a lot of failure, there is a lot of, you know, frustration, but also understanding that it's about promoting our work collectively, right, and recognizing each other. And I think that in a way, if you think in a very roundabout way, isn't that what you do when someone comes out to you, that you try to feel them and treat them as fully human, to see for who they are, celebrate them? So in a way, that's kind of the lesson I take that we can use in our own professional life. That's what I had.
We wish to thank all the panelists for participating and allowing us to record the session.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.